Hi, this is Alexander Rossi, 2008 Formula BMW America's and World Final Champion, and you're listening to F1Weekly.com.
There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Steven, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. Nasser Hamid will be bringing us Motorsports Mondial in the second part of the show. This is podcast number 484, February 3rd, 2010. Steven?
This F1Weekly podcast is brought to you by Google Ads. Google Ads gets you the goodies you want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steven. On today's program, Renault show off a radical exhaust system. Fernando goes to the top. Kubica not happy with the Pirelli tires. Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid. And special repeat interview with Clive Chapman. Steve, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Wonderful, Mr. Rogers. And yourself?
Absolutely excited. The cars are on track. Some are 2010, but the important people are 2011. And we're talking excitement, excitement, excitement. And of course, the big talk of the town was the Renault, Lotus Group, whatever exhaust system coming out of the front pods to blow the floor.
Ooh.
It's exciting, and I'm pretty pumped up about it. And then some people are not pumped up about it at all. So, you know, what can you do? But
there are cars on track. Who cares?
There is, that's true. That's true. But anyway, Ross Brawn was asked about it, and he said about the R31 exhaust system, he said that I don't think you'll see probably a number of teams with different solutions before you get to Bahrain, but he doesn't believe anybody's going to go out and start copying this thing, and I don't blame him because, really, we don't even know if it's going to work yet, but it sounds great on paper.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like we were talking about the blown diffusers that came into vogue last season. You know, if you can use that exhaust to get you some extra downforce,
you need to get everything out of the car, so the exhaust has to be used efficiently. But apparently, the side pod exhaust, apparently, which exits at the front of the car to blow gases along the underbody, was a pretty good radical design. And, Renault has been talking about how they're hoping to get in the top three, which is sort of huge.
Top three would be a major improvement, you know, but it's going to be a bit of a challenge because we know that Ferrari's going to be there. McLaren's going to be there. Yeah. Red Bull's going to be there.
Everybody's
Mercedes is probably going to be there.
More than likely.
You know, it's kind of a tough nut to crack.
And that's why they're doing some radical things. So kudos to them. I mean, if at least they're trying and making the extra effort.
Well, you know, you've got to, because if you go back and look 2 years ago, the reason Braun won the championship is because they thought out of the box and got the double diffuser built and on their car and were really the only ones with it. And that gave them the head start they needed to win the season.
I agree. So interesting stuff, and we'll see how long or how many other teams copy this Renault exhaust system does perform.
Exactly. You probably won't really see anybody moving towards copying it until it shows performance. You may have a couple of teams who have basically assigned an engineer to look at, you know, the possibilities, you know, teams that have lots of engineers to go send one off to do that kind of work. But you probably won't see someone else with it until, you know, second or third race of the year. If, you know, suddenly Renault's running away.
I agree. Mercedes Grand Prix, Nico Rosberg out today. And a lot of the drivers have been talking about the same thing. And that's how many buttons now they have on the steering wheel, which means now they have KERS. Now they have the movable rear wing. And some of them think it's a little too much to focus on, especially Robert Kubica. He was saying, and I'll get back to Rosberg in a second. Robert Kubica came out and said, I thought I was better prepared. Maybe it's because the winter was so long, and maybe it's because it's quite complicated. It sounds very easy having to press two buttons, but when you have to upshift, downshift, turn the car, stuff like that, in some places it's distracting. Let's just say it's difficult to combine full concentration when driving at 100% and operating those things perfectly. So, interesting. I think Nico had a similar thought. He says he was comfortable in the car, but other than that, there were a few things with, he's dealing with braking with KERS that you need to learn, but apparently they had some issues with their KERS not working. You think it's working, but it's not working. So obviously, first few days of testing, there's going to be a lot of things not going right. But Rosberg said he felt comfortable in the car immediately. And the other big talk of the town from everybody was tire degradation from the Pirellis. Apparently, it seems to be 6 times worse than it was with the Bridgestones.
Wow.
We'll see what happens. Obviously, Pirelli still has work to do.
Yeah, well, you know, I wonder what tires they're using in Valencia. You got to think what... You know, are they having trouble getting heat in the tires with it being cooler than it would be during a race period? Blah, blah, blah. But if they're wiping out 6 times faster, maybe we're looking at 2 pit lanes, you know, pit visits to get through the race.
Robert Kubica was saying that these things are degrading so fast, it's not a problem if we're doing 6 pit stops.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's something they're going to have to figure out. Fernando Alonso said, it was not easy to keep the tires consistent. We see some drop in the tires when they are new. The first lap is good, and then you lose 2 or 3 seconds a lap. Then you are more or less consistent, but obviously too slow. And Robert Kubica said he thought the tire degradation seen at Valencia was too extreme, and he acknowledged that weather conditions, track characteristics could be playing a factor in making the situation more extreme. Yes, it's too big, he said. At least if you want to have 5 or 6 stops in a race, then it's great. But then we will need more tires.
Yeah.
So
a lot more tires.
Good point from Robert Kubica. Heikki Kovalainen came out in the new Lotus T128. And of course, there's a lot of car acronyms you need to learn at the beginning of the season. So if I make a mistake, please forgive me. But Heikki Kovalainen, they had some power steering problems. He could hardly get a few laps in. But, of course, it was joy, joy, joy. This feels like a great car compared to last year. Well, I'm glad he said that. I mean...
Yeah. It's too bad you can't turn. But at least it's a better car.
Right. And let's not forget that they're Renault-powered and have Red Bull gearboxes. So I would think that obviously drivability is going to improve.
Well, you're going to have much better power to the track with that combination than you would have, you know, with the Cosworth, and I guess they were home-built powertrains, basically. Correct. the gearbox. So you know you've got a first-class powertrain in the car, which is going to be very helpful because it means you're going to have torque out of the corners. You're going to be able to, you know, get up and go and get through your gears well without, you know, worrying. Lotus, half of the problems Lotus had in the last season, I believe, were hydraulic type stuff.
Well, hydraulics with the gearbox, because that's what makes everything go together. And speaking of hydraulics, of course, Mark Webber had some hydraulic issues. Apparently, a master cylinder. I think they had more pedal issues, and it could be the spacing of the pedal, the length of the pedal, the throw of the pedal, the color of the pedal. all of these things, you know, some of these drivers, you know, they're our divas.
Yep.
So
wasn't in the right spot to work with his knee pad.
And obviously, all so far in the past few days, it's been Fernando Alonso, Sebastian Vettel, and Paul Di Resta. Sticking with the top three. Very impressive. Of course, he's in the VJM04, Stephen. Make a note of that.
Is that this year's car or last year's car?
That's last year's car. The VJM04 is coming out next week, but they're testing in 2010 car right now.
Which so is the 03?
Don't get me started, because it can't really be the 03. I'm sure they've done a few things, so it's probably an 03.5.
Or 03B.
Or Rev B, or whatever you want to call it. Including McLaren, who's running a hybrid.
No, not a hybrid. Please.
It's got curves. You can actually technically put.
You can actually call it a hybrid.
Yes. So, but Di Resta, of course, entering Formula One in 2011 on the back of winning the DTM title last season. Pretty good stuff. He says, quote, another good day of testing for the team, gathering lots of information for the guys to work on as we prepare for the debut of the 2011 vehicle. We're now understanding a lot more about the performance of the Pirellis and the differences between the compounds, particularly with regards to long and shorter runs and different fuel loads. So feel good and well integrated into the team. My new role there is really positive atmosphere, which will set us up extremely well for next week when the new car testing program starts. So what's good about Di Resta, you know, he is a rookie, first year in Formula One, but he's got so much racing under his belt that I think he's going to be a great developer.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only that, but he's got, you know, he is a veteran racer, so that is always helpful. He's going to bring that professionalism to the team, and, you know, they'll be able to draw on that experience to improve the car and improve the team.
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes was from Nico Rosberg. He says, quote, I learned how to handle the curves with all the buttons and systems. It is very complicated for sure, and it is going to take some time to get used to. So I think everybody's running that learning curve with the extra buttons.
Well, you've got the issue that, you know, you've basically added two more tasks to the driver's load while he's driving, that being curves and the new back wing. Maybe that's only one.
Yeah, but
the new one, because they had the front wing last year. Now it's the back wing, so maybe that's the same task.
Well, the rear wing has to be adjusted, I believe, manually.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense, because when are you going to be using that? You're going to be using that on a long straight. You're going to tone that down for a long straight. And what do you usually have at the end of a long straight?
Braking.
And a tight corner where you want downforce.
There's going to be some problems. And these things have been predicted, trust me. Now, one of the cars I thought that looked really good was the Mercedes Grand Prix. Now, and I think it's interesting that everybody's going with the higher nose. Now, I've always liked the high nose from the old days, Benetton in the mid-90s and so forth. But now, and it's funny because a lot of teams copied Red Bull last year with the crooked nose bending down. Yeah. Similar to the kind of Concorde.
Kind of the bumps with, on the well, sides.
The bumps are still around, but the high nose is definitely back, especially on the Ferrari. Mercedes has definitely a compromise with the similar Red Bull hump. But I thought the car looked good. The livery was excellent. And I really liked how they incorporated the silver and the green, more green for Petronas. I thought that was very, very nice. I also, the FW33, the Williams, I thought looked particularly nice, even though it's not covered with sponsorship logos yet. They're still working on that. And, of course, most of it is going to be from Venezuela.
Well, you get your money where you can.
But, no, I thought the Williams looked good. Quote... Like most other teams, this is from Williams, I believe this is from San Michael, the target is to have as much clear flow to the rear wing assembly as possible. It is clear that we have lifted the top wishbone and track rod and opted for a Z-bone layout. Now, see, a lot of people are switching from pull rod suspensions to push rod suspension, including Ferrari and Renault. Well, exciting.
Well, part of that, too, might be the fact that they no longer have the adjustability on that front wing.
Well, not only that, but to get everything packaged in, the pull rod suspension, I think, gives you a better option, and I think that's what Renault went in the rear. So it's going to be exciting, and I can't wait to see, because really today's testing, yesterday's testing, is just getting the bugs out.
You know, it's basically get the car on the track and make it go to make sure it will go.
But once we see them going flat out, now Fernando was putting in a lot of laps. Vettel did pretty good. I think Ferrari had the least amount of trouble, and kudos to them. And I like, so far, to be honest with you, I like how all the cars look. I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of pretty. The one thing I did notice is that the rear wing kind of has a funny look to it, because it almost looks like a J in the back, where it that front element really creates a pocket behind itself.
Right, exactly.
It's just really kind of like, how does that work?
Yeah, the other thing that the FW33 is going with is the smallest and lowest gearbox that Williams has ever made. And they're saying that it's the most extreme drive shaft designed. So a lot of people are coming out with some radical stuff here to be competitive, to get towards the front of the pack.
Some innovation to try to get more performance out of, you know, other components.
Exactly. So we're seeing shifts from push rods, Z rods, pull rod suspensions, compact gearboxes, exhaust systems that are going every which way but down. And of course, Ferrari has their own quirk on exhaust systems. So we're going to see a lot of innovation this year. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. A lot of these cars are going to look very, very different by the time we get to your favorite place, Stephen, Bahrain. So I'm pretty pumped up, I'm telling you. And I can't wait to hear Nasser, because I bet you he is overjoyed to see these cars back on track. So there you have it. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Motorsports Mondial, and of course, our repeat interview this week, Mr. Clive Chapman. So we'll be back after this brief message.
F1Weekly.com would like to thank our sponsor, San Jose Label Inc. San Jose Label is a custom manufacturer of labels that makes a variety of products. 1-4 color process labels, alphanumeric barcoding and UPC labels, blank labels, serialized asset tags, hazardous labels, bumper stickers, pin feed, static cling, hot stamp labels, and many others. Please go to www.sanjoselabel.com for info, samples requests, and graphic design. Or you can call to telephone 408-436-8221. San Jose Label is the one-stop shop for all your labeling needs.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now, as we spin the globe and go around the world with Motorsports Mondial and the king, the Karachi Kid himself, Nasser Hamid.
Greetings and racing regards. Moby lifting us up as F1 revs up in preseason testing. Are we excited, Mr. Rogers?
Absolutely. The cars look good. The people look good. The fans look good. The tracks look good.
It's the host good. Looks good as always.
Absolutely. The host always looks good, but that's because I'm using a special 2011 F1 moisturizer.
Oh, wow. but that windshield cap is saying something else. Yeah, that's from a different era.
Yeah, that's 1998 Spa-Francorchamps.
And you were
Ralph
there?
Ralph Schumacher.
And you were there?
I was.
Cool. Now, I am so happy that I'd never liked that shark fin they had on the engine cover or whatever it's called. Most of the cars do not display that, so I'm very happy.
And including the Lotus Renault and everybody else, the Red Bull Renault. They got rid of all that. There's a lot of reasons, but it was pretty hideous.
Yes, and we shouldn't be starting and talking about Red Bull Renault. We should talk about Nando. He will be seen cruising in an F-150. No, there is no Ford in his future. This is the new Ferrari, the number celebrating 150 years of Italian reunification. The Italian flag on the back of rear wing is very cool. I like it. Throwback to the good old days when cars were painted in national colors, hence the British Racing Green, Sacre Bleu, the German Silver. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. Do you like that Italian flag on the rear wing?
Oh, yeah. I thought the Ferrari looked really, really nice. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I haven't seen a car that I've not liked.
No, this is a very nice-looking car, as most Ferraris are, and most Formula One cars are.
That's true.
And talking of Formula One cars and people, let's talk about Señor Sauber. Peter Sauber is getting more and more airtime on the Mexican radio. Have you ever been on the Mexican radio?
Yeah.
I know you've eaten iguana in Tijuana, but
exactly.
Have you ever made it to the Mexican radio?
No, I haven't made it to the Mexican.
Okay, we'll send a press release to Tijuana.
Gracias, muchacho.
Yeah, de nada. After doing a deal with Carlos Slim and his Telmex company, came the signing of Sergio Perez as teammate to Kobayashi and Esteban Gutierrez as test and reserve driver. Good news and Mexican pesos keep flowing. Jose Cuervo has also jumped on the gravy train. Juan Domingo Beckman, CEO of Jose Cuervo, said, and I quote, "When we found out a Mexican driver had secured a seat with the Sauber F1 team, it all clicked for Jose Cuervo to support him and the team," end of quote. Now, if only the CEO of Pabst Blue Ribbon had similar feelings, the man from Manteca, Scott Speed, would still be in F1 in a Colt 45 sponsored Toro Rosso. I'm serious. You know, we do some fact check. Colt 45 is owned by a Pabst Brewing Company now. So,
money is money.
Yeah, money is money. But on a more serious note, Pabst was the first brewer to offer beer in a bottle. And I give them kudos for that.
Keep up the good work, Nasser.
Yes, sir. But I do have a question, Mr. Rogers. This is serious. What I would like to know is who was the first to offer beer hot dogs in a pork casing? That mystery has not yet been solved.
We have our research team digging as we speak.
Ah. Yes, let me know when they take their first bite.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, did you watch any of the Daytona 24 Hours?
I did watch some of it, but, you know, it goes on for 24 hours.
And how about you, Mr. Fobb?
I watched bits and pieces.
Yeah, same here. And it was good to see motor racing
live
action. It
was great. Very nice track. And I like the layout. And I like it when the sun sets and the lights come on and it's exciting.
When Monty is pushing and shoving, that's always
and
fun.
And percolating.
Absolutely. Okay, Daytona 24 Hours, win number 4 in 6 years for Chip Ganassi and his Telmex-sponsored team. The winning combo was Scott, hi to my family Pruitt, Memo Rojas, buenos dias to his familia in Mexico, Joey Han, and Graham Rahal. Graham Rahal's papito, Bobby, won this race 30 years ago. You know, some years ago, Alex Gurney won the race and his papito had won, and then Mark Donahue won his papito. His son, what's his name? I'm forgetting right now. Dave Donahue. And then, his papito.
Oh, my papa.
Yes, exactly. So it's good to see second, third generation
Absolutely.
Coming.
Absolutely, I think it's fun.
Yeah. Wonder when Marco will win the Daytona 24 Hours.
Micro Andretti?
Yeah, something like that.
Doesn't he actually need to get a ride first?
Yeah.
He hasn't been asked, has he?
Well, you know, all he has to do is ask Papa to enter a car, and, you know, he's always the driver, just like the A1GP situation.
I think
or ask Grandpapa to ask someone to give him a ride.
Marco seems to be falling off the radar. He's Danica.
He's more. I hear he's buddies with Paris Hilton now.
Really?
So he's checking in, checking out anytime
he
likes.
I'd be buddies with Paris.
Mm-hmm.
She's turned me down on Facebook.
Really? That's pretty. Try on MySpace. She accommodates everybody on MySpace.
Okay, I'll take a look.
Okay, the winning car was a Riley-powered BMW. And apart from Pruitt and Hahn, there was Northern California connection with the engine also, as it is tuned by Dynan Engineering, located in Morgan Hill, which is not too far from the palatial studios of F1 Weekly. Ganassi's other entry, the Four Continent Special, was second, driven by Monty, the percolated and now bloated Colombian, Scott Dixon, the Flying Kiwi, Dario, powered by Judd Franchitti, and Jimmy McMurray from Missouri. Very strong combination there in terms of driving prowess. BBC commentator and ex-Grand Prix driver and one-time teammate to Michael Schumacher and one-time sparring partner to Ayrton Senna was fourth with Mark Blundell, Mark Patterson, and Zach Brown, who owns United Autosports, which is the team that entered this car, and is the founder and CEO of Just Marketing, a major player in motorsports sponsorship these days. And we did an interview with him, very, very nice guy. Yes, really enjoyed talking to him. Now we come to Capital One segment, What's in Your Wallet? Previously, this was known as driver signings. Now it's looking like bring a money, get a... it's just becoming like a, Dodgem cars, or, like a Malibu Grand Prix thing.
That's the modern world, because everybody's struggling for cash. I mean, that's why you have your Maldonados, your Carthagians. It's bizarre, but...
Hard to believe Romain Grosjean does not have a ride in Formula One.
He works at the bank. He doesn't own the bank, NASA.
Very true. I mean, this is a guy who always had Kobayashi's number, Sebastian Buemi's number, Pastor Maldonado's number. Nico Hülkenberg won the GP2 championship in his rookie year.
Yeah, he had the number so he could call him so they'd take him out to lunch, because they're making the money he's not.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
But Grosjean's going to make a name for himself, I think, this year in GP2 by winning the championship, because really, if he wants to get back in Formula One, he has no alternate choice. He's got to do that.
This would be, I think, his third year in GP2.
Well,
may not be third full year, but third attempt. He has to win, and he's very good. He's a very good racing driver. There's no question about it.
Right.
Okay. Formula One Lotus Renault. After enrolling mega monster talents such as Feroz Fawzi and Ho Pin Tung, they have now strengthened their reserve driver lineup by signing Yann Cheruz. Genie is out of the bottle, I guess.
Now, are we talking about Danny Behar Lotus or Tony Fernandez Lotus?
Man, this is so confusing. I think this is Danny Behar special.
They've also signed Bruno Senna and Romain Grosjean.
Oh, yeah.
Now, yeah, they've got more reserve drivers than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah. And when was the last time Feroz Fawzi rattled Romain Grosjean's cage?
Never.
Yeah, this is all about money. And Ho Pin Tung, I understand, he is part of the Genie driver development program,
right?
Whatever development that he can do there. I'll tell you, I was talking to a gentleman who is involved in motor racing right now, and I've said this to some other people who have clients in GP2. It's very simple. If your driver does not win a GPD championship first year, you can forget about getting a plum ride. Whitmarsh and Montezemolo are not calling. And if you go into second, third year or more, then the only way you can come in is somebody writes a check for you. Either it's Pedovesa or Petronas or Phillips Petroleum from Bartlesville, Oklahoma. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Amazing. And here, this proves the point. Amazing what money can buy. Some years ago, Adam Khan, who drove for Team Pakistan in year one of A1 GP competition, he was signed by Renault in the halcyon days of Bravo Bravo as a demonstration driver. And when I was at Abu Dhabi, actually at Hockenheim, one of the GP2 owners told me that it was pathetic how much money the Khan family paid to Flavio to get that ride. So it's
amazing. And this is just a demonstration
driver. Demonstration driver.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Anyway, move on to DTM German touring cars. 2010 F3 Euro Series champion Eduardo Mortara, also known as Edo, he is close to confirming deal with Audi. And Audi, because he was driving a Volkswagen powered engine in F3 when he won the championship. And I've been emailing back and forth with him. He is kind enough to do a digital dialogue with us, so I'm expecting his answers anytime soon. So our repertoire increases even while we are not there in person.
It's beautiful.
Yes. Bobby D, real name Robert Dornbosch, may have a door open with Mercedes, so that's good for him. Alexander Prema, your homeboy, is hoping to get a drive with BMW, or as he would say, BMW, or something like that, when they entered DTM in 2012. Prema was fired by Audi for taking part in the New York Marathon. He was supposed to be recovering from his big crash at Adria in Italy, which was a very scary accident. And I must say, pissing off Germans is never a good idea.
Or pissing on Germans is never a good idea.
No, that's even worse. Okay, now we move on to F3 Euro Series. 19-year-old Swede Felix Rosenqvist will race with Berlin-based Muke Motorsports. Last year he was fifth in German F3. Another 19-year-old Colombian, Carlos Munoz, is moving from Muke to last year's championship-winning team, Signature Team. German F3 news. Young Dutch driver and friend of F1 Weekly, Hannes van Asseldonk, will race with Dutch team Van Amersfoort. Hannes raced in Formula BMW Europe last year and won races in the Italian Formula Abarth series. He is from the town of Bokel. Jarno Trulli also raced in German F3 in days gone by. Talking of Formula BMW Europe, another driver who raced in the final year of the series in 2010 was recently in America testing for a junior series, and I was chatting with him quite frequently the last 10 days. Things went well, and hopefully he will be announcing his deal soon. Per his request, I am on the Belinda Carlisle program. Lips are sealed, but we'll talk when the deal is all go-go.
Keep up the good work, Nass.
Trying, sir. Now we come to GP2, your favorite series. Every time car wins, it's a Renault engine.
Can't get better than that.
Exactly. Comrade Mikhail Alishin and chap Max Wilton will race for Trevor Carlin's team. Alishin won the 2010 World Series by Renault, and Chilton raced in GP2 with Thiago Monteiro's Ocean Racing Technologies. The Portuguese do love the ocean.
I know. I feel sleepy just thinking about it.
Yeah. I think we should have called this team Vasco da Gama, you know, Motorsports or Adventure. Wow.
Or Tsunami.
Whoa. A little below the belt there, Mr. Rogers. Anyway, iSport will have second-year driver Sam Bird, who is one of the favorites to land the title, and young Swede Marcus Ericsson. Marcus is a pretty nice kid, and he will be in his second year, and he's managed by Kenny Brack. Oliver Turvey, quite a talented chap, will race for Thiago Monteiro's team, in GP2 Asia at least, and hopefully I'm hoping he gets a drive in the full season, main Europe in season. He's a pretty good driver. He was with this British organization called Racing Steps, which promote and sponsor young drivers. They have dropped him for this year, so, you know, we wish him well. And talking of GP2, preseason testing is happening this week at Abu Dhabi, or as they call it in some racing circle, Abu Dhabi, and the Asian Series will start there next weekend. Talking of testing, Mr. Romain Grosjean was the fastest on opening day, followed by Jules Bianchi. Esteban Gutierrez of Mexico was 8th. I expect a junkyard-style dogfight between Grosjean, Jules Bianchi, and Sam Bird for the championship, and Rookie of the Year fight should be between Esteban Gutierrez and Mikhail Alishin. And I'm really, really excited about the new GP2 car. Is very good in the coming season. But one thing for sure, if a rookie wins the championship, it will super tramp the dreams of F1 for second and third year GP2 drivers. They will be well advised to take a jumbo, cross the water, see America in Indy cars. Breakfast in America is always good and filling. Love those country-style potatoes, don't you, Mr. Rogers?
I do, too.
Yes, Clark and I get together once in a while, and we do a big, hearty, all-American breakfast, lots of coffee. When is our next get-together?
When you're buying.
When I'm buying?
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Jalapenos are on me.
Oh, they are the best. Okay, next, IHOP 2 World Series by Renault, continuing the breakfast theme. Their season will start in April in Spain. Battle Royale is expected between two Red Bull-supported drivers, Daniel Ricciardo of Australia, who was second in the series last season, and Jean-Éric Vannes of Francia, who Napoleonized the British F3 last year, completely dominated and won the championship. First Frenchman to win the British championship.
How do they call him the Emperor now?
They do?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very good. He is very quick. You know when this guy, what's his name, Brendan Hartley was let go and they put him in the car, he was lightning quick from day one. So this guy is serious talent. And like he told me when I interviewed him, his family owns a karting center in Paris or near Paris, so obviously he was always running around. But, you know, if you're quick, you're quick. Simple as that. Indy cars, back to the base for your homeboy, Sébastien Bourdais. The Le Mans native was at Sebring earlier this week testing for Dale Coyne team. And we hope he can land a drive in Indy cars as he was very successful in Champ cars, winning four championships in a row and getting into quite a situation with Paul Tracy on more than one occasion.
Yeah, those days are a long, long time ago, and I think he's going to have a lot of competition with some of the young guns that are in Indy now.
Well, there is some very good talent right now. This guy, Will Power from Australia, is very good.
Exactly. And
the other thing, too, is that Bourdais is not really an oval racer by training, so I think he may find that a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and I'm surprised he wants to come back, but he wants to come back to America, but when you need a job, you need a job.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he was well received here, and I think he was very happy with all the success he had.
I know, but I don't think his wife liked America too much. You know, too much ketchup and yellow mustard.
Well, he can buy her an apartment in Louisiana, French quarters, and she'll be happy.
Yeah, you think?
I think so.
And then mosquitoes.
Then we always have Christopher D. Hardy. He can fake that he's half
That's
French.
True. And Angelina Jolie hangs around there, too.
Oh, wow. See? And Brett Favre is from that part of the country, too.
Yeah, too bad. My cousin took his job.
Oh, wow. So there'll be a lot of love in Louisiana. Louisiana Sunday afternoon, baby. Okay.
I'm ready for some quail eggs.
Oh, yeah? Cool. Okay, Indy Lights. Are you okay, Steve?
Yes.
Okay, Indy Lights. Joseph Newgarden from Tennessee is looking to join Andretti Autosports, basically giving up on his F1 dream. Last year, he raced in GP3, and we wish him all the best in his racing career, whatever side of pond he is racing. And, you know, I just want to make a point here, not a reflection of Joseph Newgarden, but, I read a lot of racing press releases and this and that, especially now we're doing this F1 Weekly thingy for many years now. I've been following his career for a few years, and there were all these press releases coming from Scholarship USA team, and he was mega successful in Formula Ford. Formula Ford is very basic. You know, 30 years ago, it was the series. It was what Formula Renault is now. And like I've always said, you know, we don't wish anybody anything good or bad. I mean, results speak for themselves. And when he did so well in all these Formula Ford events in England, here, whatever, when he got into GP3, just a very, very different world for him. So it's not easy winning in Europe when it comes to motor racing. And you really have to be at the top of your game, or it's sayonara pretty quickly. What do you think?
I agree with you. No, it's tough. Sometimes that transition is not as easy for some people as it is for others, especially if you don't have enough experience in the European formulas.
And if you look at all these guys, you know, a lot of drivers came from Brazil, like Pisonia, Mario Haberfeld, this and that, and just flushed out after a few years, Zonta. Anyway, but the cream will rise to the top.
Eventually.
And every year somebody will be a Formula One world champion.
Fernando?
Yeah, you never know.
Robert Kubica.
Fernando, let me call Petrov. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, American Le Mans Series, boys from Brazil are back. Talking of Brazil, Cristiano Da Mata and Bruno Junqueira, two other people who had F1 aspirations, will race for RSR Jaguar team this season. Da Mata drove for Toyota in F1, and Bruno had a chance at Williams, but Monty and Button got in the way. And, you know, Cristiano Da Mata had such a bad taste about Formula One that when he was let go, Michael Schumacher was winning anything and everything. He made a comment at that time that I won't stay in Formula One even if they offer me Michael Schumacher's Ferrari. So.
Well, you know what? He bombed. And
yeah.
But he did lead one race, didn't he?
Did he?
For a couple of laps.
Many people have Marcus Winkelhoff.
Yeah, my friend.
Yeah.
Pit rotation will do that for you.
Yeah. Now we come to MotoGP preseason testing taking place this week at Sepang. home of the Malaysian Grand Prix. Casey Stoner, now on a Honda, was numero uno on opening day, followed by Jorge Lorenzo, or as Rossi will say, Jorge Lorenzo, on a Yamaha, and the second Honda of Danny Pedrosa. This guy, Lorenzo, has really rained on Pedrosa's parade to become a world champion. Ben Spies was the top Amerikanski in fifth in his Yamaha, and I expect this kid to get his first win this year. He's very, very good. He is replacing Valentino Rossi, who was 12th fastest on his new ride, Ducati, and just ahead of his teammate from Kentucky, Mr. Nicky Hayden. And I'm glad Nicky Hayden has a world championship under his belt, which is good, and hopefully he'll get another one soon. Finally, a moment in motorsports history with Mika Hakkinen. The man from Vanta made his F1 debut in the streets of Phoenix, Arizona, 1991, where Moa met him or ran into him in the lobby of a hotel, and we had a little chit-chat. He was world champion in 1998 and 1999 with McLaren. Here the Finn is being interviewed after a great victory over Michael Schumacher in the Belgian Grand Prix and after winning the Spanish Grand Prix. Take it away, Mr. Tapia, and Tata from yours truly.
As a consequence of the spin that you just mentioned, you made up for it with an absolutely spectacular and heart-stopping overtaken manoeuvre. Can you talk us through that?
Yes, it was quite a different one.
Mika, the perfect lights to flag victory. It looked very easy, was it?
Oh yeah, it was so easy, you can't believe it. No, it wasn't.
Thanks, Nas, for another outstanding Motorsports Mondial, and of course with a few supplementals in there. Just
zingers of the day also.
Exactly, zingers of the day, just for good measure. Thank you, Nasser, and of course, stay tuned, everyone, for the repeat interview with Clive Chapman.
As you know, Mr. Rogers, in the history of motor racing, there are many names that will live forever. Alfa Romeo, Auto Union, Bugatti, Maserati, and of course, Lotus. The black and gold JPS Lotus is a classic for all times. Colin Chapman was one of the great original thinkers of Grand Prix motor racing. Moss, Clark, Hill, Rin, Fittipaldi, Peterson, Andretti, and Senna all won in Lotus F1 machinery. His son Clive is now preserving the rich heritage of this great mark. I would like to thank him very much for his time and sharing wonderful memories. How many school kids can claim they were picked up from a school by a Formula One world champion? It's a lot of fascinating stories from him. And they also have a very nice website, which I would encourage our listeners to visit. It's www.classicteamlotus.co.uk, and please take a look. So once again, thank you to everybody, and hope our listeners enjoy this conversation.
Okay, folks, we are in serious British racing green territory with Mr. Clive Chapman of Classic Team Lotus. Sir, a great pleasure and honour to be here. How are you today?
Good, thanks. A little bit cold in the old workshops as autumn's approaching, but we're in good shape.
Good. Before we go back to the rich history of this mark, please tell us about what's happening at Classic Team Lotus and what's the main reason for establishing this team?
My family has a collection of cars that I wanted to restore and maintain, look after, and we set up Classic Team Lotus and decided to offer our services to other owners around the world. And I was fortunate enough to be able to hook up with a number of the original Team Lotus mechanics who based in the original workshops at Hethel next to the car factory. We provide our services, as I say, to owners in Australia and Japan and America and Europe, obviously, as well, to restore and maintain and then take the old Lotus F1 cars racing.
Okay. Lotus 38 chassis number 1 took part in only one race, thousands of miles away from home. Please tell our listeners about this race and the winning driver.
Well, it's the greatest race, and it was won by the greatest driver, I'd like to think. Jimmy, it was his third attempt, and I think when Team Lotus first arrived at Indy, there was a certain amount of kind of understandable reaction, negative reaction from the locals, if you like. And Jimmy, by the time 1965 came around and he won, I think genuinely the Americans were as pleased as anybody to see Jimmy win. because he'd created such a great impression with his sense of sportsmanship and accepting the circumstances in which he didn't win in 63 and 64. When it actually all came good in 65, it was good news all round.
I understand this car is home these days, and we had the pleasure of looking at it. What is the plan in terms of restoration and possibly running this car in some historic events?
The car belongs to the Henry Ford in Detroit, and it's the most extraordinary museum that myself and Bob Dance went to earlier this year. And the Henry Ford has taken the decision to share the car with the Europeans, I guess, and send it over and displayed it at Goodwood Festival last July. And we've done an initial review and report on the car and presented it to them. They're coming to see us next week with a view to deciding what to do in terms of either preserve it in its existing condition or to make it run again, possibly for Goodwood next year.
Now, one of your world championship and Indy 500 winning driver, Graham Hill, he discouraged his son from going into motor racing, saying Damon was too smart to be a racing driver. What was your dad's approach to your interest in racing, if you had any, in trying to become a racing driver?
Well, he knew I was too smart because I got a mechanical engineering degree where he only got a civil engineering degree. But other than that, he steered me into powerboats. And I raced in powerboats from about 15 until age 22, and then called it a day. And by then, I think I felt I'd rather missed the boat on going circuit racing, and had great fun in powerboats and won the championship, and it was a big adventure. But I do rather regret not having had more determination to follow that course after powerboating, and I really do admire Damon immensely, particularly given that his circumstances were much more challenging than mine. But he didn't let that deflect him from his target, and he went on to become a very worthy world champion.
Now, growing up in a house full of rich motor racing history, apart from Lotus and Lotus drivers, were there other cars or F1 drivers that you thought were, you know, very good, or as a kid growing up, you had some heroes?
No.
Okay, that's very easy. Okay, Enzo Ferrari.
It was just Lotus. It was Lotus or Lotus, frankly, and I'm a bit tunnel visioned like that.
Okay. Enzo Ferrari and your dad are two of the greatest contributors to Formula One and motor racing in general. What is your earliest memory of your dad's passion for motor racing?
Passion. I think just getting to the circuits, you know, leaping in his plane and flying from Hethel to whatever circuit in Europe, and getting the hire car and driving at ridiculous speeds towards the circuit, and then arriving and almost always having a fight with the people on the gate and barging in and being smuggled into the pits, and it, which isn't really much to do with motor racing, but it does demonstrate his passion to a degree. He was just a 100 mile an hour kind of guy who never liked to be told what he couldn't do, and always enjoyed applying his intelligence and his genius to making the most out of any situation. So it was passionate, not just at the circuits, but, you know, away from the circuits, the family life and holidays. It was always flat out.
Mr. Colin Venterville was obsessed with beating those bloody red cars. Was winning the only option for your dad, or did he also have Ferrari as his target?
I think Ferrari was the car that he was really interested to beat. He was principally interested in winning. But he certainly had a respect for Ferrari and Mr. Ferrari.
From Moss to Mansell, many great drivers drove for your team. Can you please share some thoughts on drivers you got to know personally? Any stories, any, you know, like of human element that you can share with our listeners?
My big hero was Elio De Angelis, who was with the team when my father died. And Elio really stuck with the team at a time when he could easily have moved on. And he was also very generous to me personally, gave me encouragement and advice. And he was a handsome young Italian playboy racing driver with a gorgeous girlfriend, and I was an impressionable teenager, and or kind of late teens, early 20s, and he was just all round, you know, top man really, and also did more Grand Prix for Team Lotus than any other driver, which is often overlooked. A really significant figure, and helped the team get back to winning ways after my father died. So definitely important. And Emerson Fittipaldi is another great guy who occasionally now drives his old Lotuses at historic meetings that we prepare for him, particularly the 72. And he has very fond memories of my father and the team in those days. And I remember Emerson as a schoolboy. He picked me up once in school, and you know, that was the ultimate wow. Look, Clive Chapman's just been collected by Emerson Fittipaldi, and yeah, off we went. And racing at a time when there was also a great sense of fun still. Other drivers, Elio and Emerson are the two that really stand out, and Nigel Mansell is often very generous in his recollections of my father and the Chapman family, and that, which is always appreciated.
Yeah, no, any time I've spoken to Mansell, Fittipaldi, and as I mentioned, we interviewed Mario Andretti, they speak very, very highly of your dad, which, you know, doesn't surprise, knowing for me as a fan how passionate your dad was about motor racing. Now, going back to Elio De Angelis, were you at Österreichring when he won that great race over Keke Rosberg, 82?
No, I wasn't there. I was watching it on the telly, and I remember kind of kneeling on the floor in front of the screen going absolutely mental, and Elio just squeaking it. We've got that car in our collection, 91 Chassis 8, which is Elio's first win and Dad's last win, and so, you know, quite an important car for us. And whenever we run the car in historic F1 occasionally, it always brings back nice memories.
Okay, now, you know, I go through old magazines and old newspapers about motor racing. Elio De Angelis was not happy with Peter Waugh when Ayrton Senna joined your team. He was under the impression that when Mansell would leave, he would become the team leader. And I remember him saying in an interview that this was all the fault of Peter Waugh because he started dancing around Senna. Can you share some thoughts on that, please?
I think Peter Waugh is an honourable man, and I don't think he would have committed himself to something and then gone back on it. Making a commitment and giving an impression is a different thing, two different things. I'm sure that Elio must have found it very difficult when Ayrton came to the team. Ayrton was very different to Elio. At the time, to begin with, Elio really matched Ayrton in a way that very few of Ayrton's teammates have ever managed. And he was leading the championship in front of Ayrton until about two-thirds of the way through the season. So I think the fact that the team leant towards Ayrton, I think, probably came about from Ayrton's extreme attitude towards winning. He consumed him completely, motor racing, whereas Elio was a more sympathetic, more to life than the motor racing, if you see what I mean. It was sad for all of us, and it must have been very disappointing for Elio. But I'm sure that Peter, as I say, you know, wouldn't have let Elio down on an issue of giving his word.
Now, how did you find Ayrton Senna when he joined your team, both as a person and as a driver?
Well, I didn't know Ayrton particularly well because I was at university and then working in London, so I was away from the team when he was with Lotus. But on the occasions that I did meet him, he was always very polite and expressed an appreciation for Lotus history, and he enjoyed the role of being Lotus number one, always very generous to my mother, who was fulfilling the role of founder, really, in the wake of my father's death. So And the mechanics, you know, really rooted for Ayrton big time because he was, you know, so dedicated to winning and qualifying the number of times that he stuck it on pole when, you know, it seemed beyond him, but he still managed it. And they loved him for that. And Chris Dinage, who's the team manager here, and Nick Yallop, who's on the race team at Classic Team Motors, they both worked very closely with Ayrton, and Bob Dance, in fact. Mm-hmm. And they have very fond memories of him. In a different way to their memories of, say, Ronnie, for instance. But they really appreciated, because they're all racers, you know, the mechanics, and they really liked Ayrton's singular focus on winning.
His first win, Portugal 1985, classic Grand Prix win. Were you there? Your thoughts on that win?
I wasn't there, but I've seen it on video many times, and remembered watching it on the telly at the time. Of course, we have the car 97 T2 in running condition in the collection, and that's just a very special piece of F1 history. You know, that's the tub that Ayrton sat in and produced that incredible drive, which he nominated as his greatest ever race. Really? Donington as his greatest ever lap. But Estoril as his greatest ever race. And it really was one of those performances. Even though he was miles in front, he still kept up the speed and kept up the pace, because it was those conditions where anything could happen, and you just had to drive, you know, 100%. People who were driving at 95% were just as likely to aquaplane off. A superb result.
Now, your dad was not at Hockenheim in April 1968. Do you recall your dad's reaction, or how you got the news yourself?
Well, I was only 5 years old, so I don't remember it. But I know that Dad was on holiday with the family, and Jim Enderwright, the chief mechanic, gave him the news, and he found it extremely difficult to cope with, because Jimmy was more than an employee, if you like. That's not really the right word, but you know what I mean. He really was a close friend, someone he shared his challenges with, if you like. And I think the team that will tell you, the race mechanics will tell you, that they got the impression that was it, you know, that was the end for Team Lotus, and they didn't really expect to be going Grand Prix racing again. But largely down to Graham Hill, who stepped in to really pull the team through the Spanish Grand Prix, which was the next Grand Prix, and he won that Grand Prix and then went on to win the World Championship. You know, I think that kind of Graham managed to pull the team through that particularly dark period for Dad and through to the other side, and then Dad was able to get going again.
What's the biggest legacy or lesson your dad has left for you, both as a person and as a racing fan?
Well, as a the collection of cars, actually, is the biggest legacy, because that's ended up being my career.
Yeah.
This is my principal source of earning a living. And certainly it's my principal source of achievement, other than my family and children, of course. I think I've got a bit of a... at times I display something of his attitude in as much as anything is possible, you know, if you really put your mind to it. I don't seem to have quite his drive and confidence. Certainly he had a lot of confidence, people will tell you. He had kind of confidence verging on barefaced cheek at times, I think. It's a wonderful thing to work, particularly with the mechanics that worked with Dad on the cars that he designed. And then we go to all the classic Grand Prix circuits with our customers, and even including Monaco every couple of years, and then the Goodwood meetings, you know, and it really is very special, particularly to take my children now and my sister's children to Goodwood, and we have a weekend there, and they see Grandad's cars, you know, winning at the revival or being appreciated by all the fans at the festival. It's a really lovely thing.
Talking of kids and the family, any chance you might see a Chapman driving a race car soon?
Not driving one, I don't think. We've restored my old... I've got a daughter and two boys, and the two boys and I restored my old go-kart recently, and they roar up and down Grandma's drive in that.
Okay.
And as I say, they're very keen on coming to the events, and they are now working in the workshop now and again, and Bob Dance encourages them. And when they come to the meetings, they try and help out a little bit. And hopefully they'll be engineers rather than racing drivers.
OK. Okay. Now, you know, Peter Windsor, the journalist, I was reading his article, this was in F1 Racing some years ago, and he said no two people could dislike each other more than Peter Waugh and Nigel Mansell. Your comment on that, please. And this is a fairly well-known fact about the two.
Yeah, it's not something that they're both gentlemen at the end of the day. They haven't mentioned it to me, but I'm sure there was a certain level of antipathy there. But, you know, if you can't think of something nice to say, it's best not to say anything.
Okay. Apart from Lotus fans in the UK, where do you see the most interest or inquiries regarding Team Classic Lotus?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yeah, I'm sure you have a big base of fans here in the
Classic Team Lotus.
Yeah, classic Team Lotus. Yeah. Where do you see interest in your history of your team or cars and, you know, heritage of this organization coming from? My guess would be United States and Japan.
No, mainly it's England and Europe, actually. Japan probably next up. The Lotus brand is extremely strong in Japan. Senna was a huge hero. Jim Clark in the 60s, green and yellow. The Lotus Elan is very popular out there. And America is there's a very active owner club in America. And they're kind enough to invite us out to their Lotus owners gathering each year, which is a real treat. And they have a much better gathering in America than we do in England, which just goes to show that the Americans are always good at organising these kind of things. We have a website, and we just do a quarterly review and tell people what we're doing and which events we're going to. And I think that's attracted a kind of a bit of a following. But mainly Lotus owners, Lotus road car owners, are the source of interest in what we're doing, I think. And even the new owners, who may not know much about Lotus history, by a Lotus Elise or a Lotus Evora. And some of them will be interested in the Team Lotus history, and we'll get to know them through that. We do workshop tours, and we sell our merchandising and stuff, and license the scale models. The scale models are really popular, so it'll kind of adds up.
Okay. And you mentioned your website, which is very nice. You also have a couple of Formula One cars for sale. Who is your typical buyer?
I'd say someone, anyone can, anyone we like. So 40s, 50s, maybe raced when they were younger, then got a proper job, and maybe, you know, have been successful and are now able to afford the time and the money to actually savour what racing a Formula One car would have been like had they made it as a youngster.
Okay, let me ask you a question. If somebody wants to buy a car which has a significant history for your organisation, would you sell it to a person who is anywhere and is paying the price, or do you want it to go to certain markets so that it can come back, or you may have access to it for whatever reason, a demonstration, or so it can come back to like a Goodwood race? You know what I'm trying to say?
We don't really sell many cars. Okay. The two that we've got on the website are because we've got two of each of them, and we don't need two of each of them. So it's not really up to us. I was just joking when I said, you know, as long as they're nice, it's not really up to us to be arbiters of who can own a Lotus F1 car. Most of the cars are bought and sold in the market, and we're not involved. Our main interest is in helping existing owners to maintain and restore and preserve their cars. In saying that, there's a Type 81 on the website for sale at the moment, and the principal motivation for advertising that for sale is in the hope that the owner would want to race it in the historic F1 Championship. So I'm kind of, you know, I suppose, hoping that we can nudge it in that direction. But I wouldn't be arrogant enough to suggest that we can, you know, vet potential owners. So.
Okay. You are planning to create a heritage centre for Classic Team Lotus. When can we expect this to be operational?
Yes, good question. And my family has a very significant collection of cars that we've invested a lot in over the last few years with the help of Classic Team Lotus customers. And I'm hoping that Group Lotus Car Company within the next few years will be in a position to establish a heritage centre that we can participate in, and I'm certainly trying to encourage that whenever I get the opportunity. Also, Classic Team Lotus needs a new workshop We've grown quite significantly over the last 3 or 4 years, and our transporter is almost bigger than our workshop now. So we need to really come up with a modern building. The original workshop, from a historical point of view, is significant, obviously, and maybe we can keep that as some kind of visitor attraction. But a modern rectangular, warm building with all the necessary equipment in is really what we need now. So that's the kind of two parts of it. One, we want to show the cars that we've restored. The other is we need a better working environment.
You mentioned the tours you do. Can you please tell our listeners how long the tour is, and is it all year long, and what can they expect when they come? What can they see when they come here?
Well, basically, we show you the workshops, and it's whatever's in the workshop at the time. At the moment, you've got Jimmy's Type 25, Jimmy's Type 38, we've got my father's Lotus 11, Emerson's 72, Mario's 79, Elio's 91. So there's generally something interesting to look at. And we tell you about the cars, and we let people really, you know, get under their skin. We've got the archive of all the original drawings that people enjoy looking at. We give them a bit of a personal insight. I'm normally there and will introduce Classic Team Lotus and myself to them. But it's quite informal and very low level. It's not it's nothing like going around the McLaren factory. So it's a couple of hours tops, and in the evening when the workshop is closed. It's best to try and dovetail it in with the tour around the Lotus Cars factory, which is on Wednesday afternoons, and then people come to us in Wednesday evenings, and then it makes it something a bit more significant. We had some people came from Manchester the other day, which is about 6 hours drive, and I was a bit nervous throughout the tour, thinking, my God, they've come 6 hours to see this, because it's fairly amateur, really. But no, we've never had any complaints. So,
you know, it may be amateur, but I mean, history is incredible, unbelievable. Final question is, what's your favourite Lotus Formula One car?
I think I'd probably have to go for the 25. Yeah, we're fortunate that we've got two in the workshop at the moment, and there's only two running, and but it's just the most elegant looking car, incredibly simple. And in 1963 there was 10 Grand Prix in the championship, and Jimmy won 7, and it was really, you know, Lotus and Jimmy together, Dad and Jimmy together, combined to create this unstoppable machine, and it just looks so beautiful at the same time. So that's probably the one I'd choose.
Finally, how about a message for listeners of F1 Weekly, please?
Well, I appreciate your interest in F1. I know it's not always the easiest thing to follow in the States in particular. And whenever we're at a historic meeting, we're always impressed by the number of American spectators. And certainly when we go to the Lotus Owners Gathering each year, there's always a lot of questions about Formula One and the history of Formula One. And there's a new series starting over in the States, Historic Motorsport Productions, which Bobby Rahal is involved with. And I think the first race is going to be at the Barber Museum in Birmingham, Alabama, next year, and in May. And the Barber Museum. Have you been to the Barber Museum?
No.
It's the most incredible thing. So if you want to come and see Lotus history and enjoy historic F1, then try and get to the Barber Museum that weekend, because it really would be a treat, I think.
Thank you very much, sir.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, are your hosts. And apparently everybody is back at work, because we have the forum updates.
This week's forum updates from Kimix. The wait is finally over and the cars are back on the track. So it's time we came back out of hibernation and opened up the forum. First, welcome to our newest active member, Interceptor Racing, who has picked the perfect time to join us as things start getting busy on the forums with pre-season and testing discussions. If anyone else is lurking on the fringe, come on in and join us. Cyan has started a private league on fantasyracers.com. Now is the time to start thinking about your team and sign up. The more teams, the better. See the Fantasy Racer 2011 thread in the qualifying and race predictions section of the forum for more details. Recent topics have moved on to 2011 cars and the final driver signings, and the forum is starting to get busy in anticipation of the new year. which means we can now move on from recent off-season threads like Petra Eckerstone, completely grounded. Come check us out and join the discussion. You know you want to.
Thank you, Stephen. And I do like that thread on Petra. Fascinating. You know, closet space is important, Steve.
Is she friends with Paris?
I don't know, but she has a great closet. Anyway, San Francisco Formula One group, they're gearing up. If you're in the Bay Area, you need to see a Formula One race with a bunch of friends. Check out sff1.com. They get together, they drink, eat, and watch Formula One. Cameron Karting is proud to organize and support the 2011 Redline Oil Karting Championship. Cameron Karting offers CRG karts, engines, parts for all karts, engine service, driver coaching, and trackside support to Northern California karters. For more information, simply contact CameronKarting.com. I want to mention our Facebook and Twitter sites. Just do a search for F1 Weekly and add us as a friend. If you'd like to advertise or cross-promote with our website or podcast, email me at info@F1Weekly.com. I want to thank everybody who listens to the program. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.